Hey gang, this episode is brought to you by Means TV, the world's first anti-capitalist streaming service. Stick around after the episode to learn a bit more about Means and to snag a nice little discount as a thank you for supporting my channel. '23 was the least affordable year to buy a home in over a decade. It was also the year we saw a record number of people paying well over 30% of their income on rent. And if you're looking for someone to blame, you're not gonna find them here. No, for that, we gotta go to New York.
New York, New York!
New York,
New York!
New York!
It's a wonderful time!
New York, I've been there. Stinks of fish.
Because it's in these buildings that a lot of our story takes place. These nondescript glass boxes that we probably should have figured out don't make for great B-roll before a 45-minute subway ride. Anyway, these are the New York offices of real estate property managers, real estate tech companies, and private equity firms invested in real estate, including everyone's favorite, Blackstone. These companies are a huge part of why we've seen home prices skyrocket all over the US these last 20 years. Today, the median home sits at some 400 grand and costs the average American, someone making about 80K, over 40% of their income in monthly housing costs. This is about as bad as it's ever been. And just to give you an idea, 80 years ago, the average house only cost about 18 grand, roughly 180K in today's money, at a time when the average income was only a third of that, around 6K. Basically, we've seen homeownership get about twice as expensive for the average person since your grandparents bought their house for a nickel and seven strawberries. And the story isn't much better in the rental world, where more than half of all renters are paying more than the recommended 30% on housing, and over a quarter are paying more than 50%. It's gotten so bad that there's basically nowhere in the country where someone working a full-time, minimum-wage job can afford a simple one-bedroom, much less an apartment for a family.
Hold up! Time out!
How did this happen? The conventional narrative, both on TV and in Twitter econ bro replies, pins the blame on simple supply and demand.
Supply and demand dynamic.
You'll often hear this idea that what's driving up the price of housing is basically not enough homes. Too many people chasing too few houses, meaning bidding wars and competitive buyers markets. This is an Econ 101 explanation that's surprisingly persistent for just how wrong it is. The truth is that the price of homes has almost nothing to do with the actual supply. In most cases, house prices go up year after year pretty much regardless of how many homes there actually are. Sometimes housing construction stagnates and prices go up. Sometimes construction outpaces demand and prices still go up. What actually matters for the price of a house is the demand and supply of finance to both housing consumers and housing producers. And that's mostly got to do with changes in government policies since the 80s, global finance markets, and the massive generational wealth gap between the old and the new generations. But let's look at the rental market for a second. Before we get to the finance side of things, let me just show you how wrong the very basic supply and demand story is in the rental world, specifically thanks to the new popularity of rental algorithms. For that, let's go back to 2022. We were deep in the post-2020 inflationary cycle. Rents in one-bedroom apartments were up 17% from 2 years prior. And when asked to comment on why by the New York Times, this guy, Jay Parsons, fell back on the simple supply and demand explanation. Quote, "The reality is that rents can only rise as incomes rise. If people can't afford it, you can't lease it." The problem is, that was a lie. Millennials and Gen Z's wages aren't rising, and are actually lower in many places than they were for older generations. We're all paying way too much for rent. The reason Mr. Parsons is peddling this false narrative in the New York Times, though, is that his, now former, employer, RealPage, is to blame for a lot of these rents going up. For years now, tech companies like RealPage, Yardi, and their competitors have been selling a special piece of software to private landlords that allows them to aggregate all sorts of information about the apartments they own. Using that data, collected from thousands of landlords and significant chunks of any given area's rental market, RealPage's algorithm recommends things. Things like what landlords should charge and specific occupancy rates. Most of the time, pushing those two things in opposite directions. Take the occupancy rate, for example. Landlords used to shoot for around 97 to 98% occupancy. Obviously, right? You have apartments, just lease them out. Landlording's not a real job, this shit's easy. Anyway, maximizing the number of people occupying the places you own seems obvious, and even lines up with what landlords lie and say their job is, providing people with housing. In recent years, though, landlords have found that this sort of quote-unquote obvious logic doesn't hold up. According to ProPublica, RealPage's software has recommended property managers reduce their occupancy down to about 94%. Units stay empty, but thanks to the algorithm's calculation and its ability to push out the same recommendation to a ton of property managers at once, landlords actually see a net revenue increase of about 3 to 4% when they empty units and raise rents on those they keep occupied. Same goes for turnover. Using RealPage's software, landlords found that if they increase turnover by about 15%, meaning kicking out tons of people as soon as their leases end or being more liberal with evictions, they can raise rents quicker. And this has real consequences. Consequences that the CEO of RealPage knows because last year he told a trade publication, quote, "The net effect of driving revenue and pushing people out was $10 million in income. I think that shows keeping the heads in the beds above all else is not always the best strategy." This isn't normal rhetoric. It's cruel, calculated, and basically automated violence. Especially given that hundreds of thousands of people in the US are homeless, and a majority can't afford the place they live. RealPage's software, which unfortunately gets better at this extortion racket the more signups it gets, rigs the market even more in favor of landlords than it already was. By letting landlords coordinate their price hikes without actually needing to collude, just following an algorithm's recommendations, RealPage's approach kicks more people out of their homes, leaves more apartments vacant, and allows property managers sitting on hundreds of units to get a bigger chunk of people's dwindling incomes. This single example shows that the price of rent has nothing to do with the number of livable homes and everything to do with how comfortable property managers are using various price gouging techniques. In a for-profit business, they're going to be very comfortable. But underneath this thin layer of dystopian tech, there's a deeper core of private finance that's really driving all this. A big part of the landlording that exists today comes from small-time landlords. Mom-and-pop-style setups where people buy an extra property with the express purpose of leasing it out. But over time, we've seen this small-scale approach complemented by huge interest from private equity firms. Apollo Global Management, the Carlyle Group, and maybe most famously, Blackstone, to name just three big ones in a sea of private equity firms, have all recently upped their investments in real estate. In the first quarter of 2022, nearly a third of all single-family homes sold in the US were bought by private investors. And that's already not great. But some areas are seeing even more dramatic numbers. Not only that, real estate markets that investors used to not touch are seeing the same trend. Nearly 25% of mobile home purchases in 2020 and 2021 were made by private equity groups, meaning some 21 million people living on very tight budgets saw their housing get bought up en masse, and for some of them, their rents go up as much as 60%. By making cash offers and bypassing a lot of steps someone who would actually live in a house would take, like an appraisal, private equity has completely taken over real estate, swooping in and raising housing costs for everyone along the way, renters and homeowners alike. But why, right? Sure, profit is an easy answer, but it's not really an explanation for why it's so profitable for so much capital to go into real estate. So much capital, actually, that in the US, out of roughly $178 trillion of national assets, almost half, about $84 trillion, is in real estate. In the words of Robert Shiller, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, quote, "Far more important to the world's economies than the stock markets are wage and salary incomes and other non-financial sources of livelihood, such as the economic value of our houses and apartments. This is where the bulk of our wealth is found." That's a relatively new thing, and there's three parts to how we got here: government policy, generational wealth gaps, and capital's demand for liquidity. Since about the 80s, governments all over the world, including the US, have changed the way they operate pretty drastically. Where once the New Deal and the Keynesian era of the 20th century meant governments trying to run an economy with decent jobs that paid pretty well paired with decent government services, Reagan's turn to neoliberalism meant pretty much gutting all that and replacing it with personal debt. It's around this time that credit scores appeared and mortgage loans exploded. This new governmental approach has a name: house price Keynesianism. Neoliberalism means lower real wages, non-existent public services, and weaker working protections. It sucks, but you can't jump straight into it. To compensate workers for the fact that wealth was being siphoned to the top 1% much faster than before, the 80s marked a radical shift towards consumer debt, specifically mortgages. Basically, while everything was being slashed and home budgets took a hit, credit card debt and easy access to, ultimately more expensive, mortgages meant you could still live a version of the American dream, including the all-essential homeownership part. But this has a few consequences. For one, it means people are now on the hook for a lot more. Debt is a form of public control and accountability. There's this huge push for financial literacy programs to get people to take on more debt, and most importantly, get it through their heads that they have to pay these debts back and it's a moral failing if they don't. Ensuring this compliance when wages are declining is critical. Why? Because governments begin to facilitate using this housing debt as a financial instrument and integrate it into the broader economy. Housing debt becomes an asset that investors can start trading through a process called securitization. If you haven't heard about this before, basically you start with a mortgage in the primary market. The bank gives you a loan, you pay the bank back. Seems simple enough. Starting in the 80s though, the US government wanted to create a secondary market for all this debt.
For a free guide that can put you on the path to homeownership, call the Fannie Mae Foundation. We're showing America a new way home.
In 1981, Fannie Mae, the Federal National Mortgage Association, starts issuing mortgage-backed securities. 2 years later, Congress lets Freddie Mac, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, issue the first collateralized mortgage obligation. And in 1984, Congress passes the Secondary Mortgage Market Enhancement Act, which, quote, "removed statutory restrictions on investments in private MBSs by federal chartered depository institutions." And then you have the Tax Reform Act of 1986. You know what, it doesn't need to be this complicated. The point is, the government created a market for investors to bet on mortgage debt. It allowed banks to take all the mortgages they gave out, pool them together, slap a label on them so different mortgage pools could be compared, and essentially sold them to investors all over the world. It takes the illiquid physical home that someone actually lives in and turns it into a liquid, easily tradable, valuable asset that investors can pour money into. This was useful because back then, capitalists had no idea what they were going to do with all the money they were making from not paying their workers fairly. You can't leave that money just sitting there. It'll lose some of its value. And without money circulating in the economy, the risk of an economic crisis keeps growing. Capitalism is constantly running towards this very precarious situation where money stops moving, and suddenly people are left holding the bag for obligations they can no longer actually fulfill. In David Harvey's words, then you need a fix. Somewhere to fix and put money in and keep it moving. And what could be better than real estate? You have too much money, you use it to create an asset of equal worth that you'll be able to sell at some point, and you've saved your cash from sitting in the bank. The problem with real estate is that it takes time to design, build, and sell homes like this for a profit. Luckily for capitalists though, now that there's this huge secondary market in mortgage-backed securities thanks to the government, everything moves a lot faster. There's more debt, and therefore a place to put your money, if you have a lot of it, that'll keep it circulating and growing. This way, real estate becomes not just a good investment for people looking to make more money, but a source of liquidity for capitalist markets that are terrified of drying up with no more places to invest the money they've stolen. And for the rest of us, this means more expensive homes. Now that housing costs are no longer related to any sort of supply, or how useful they are for the people who actually live in them, but rather how valuable they can be made as stores of value and sources of liquidity, their prices reflect the power of capitalists over that process, and their ability to enforce debt repayment from homeowners and landlords. Real estate becomes just another overflow tank that's meant to protect capitalists from rushing into the next crisis. This also means that governments are now desperate to keep this cycle going. Mortgages are inflating house prices because families can now borrow way more than they can afford. Mortgage-backed securities inflate home prices because their value as a source of liquidity brings more money into the world of real estate. And because homeownership is now people's main avenue for building wealth in a world of declining real wages, keeping the value of these assets going up becomes a huge obsession for governments desperately trying to avoid a return to a time when people were paid more fairly. So cities weaken protections for renters to attract more corporate landlords. Neighborhoods gentrify to accommodate more sites for capital to find its fix. And public housing developments slow down everywhere and even start to be demolished to make room for privately funded construction. Some twisted reading of this might make it seem like a win-win. More money going into real estate means more or better homes, right? Not really. For this system to continue year after year, you need two things to happen. Housing prices need to constantly keep rising, meaning buying a house or staying in the rental market is almost always guaranteed to be more unaffordable from one year to the next, and people need to keep taking on more debt and being forced or guilted into paying it back. Two things that feed off each other and temporarily stave off capitalist crises, but make them way more destructive when they do hit.
I think this is the most significant financial crisis in the post-war period.
The phones say a lot of their customers are freaked out waiting to see how low the Dow will go. They're focused.
So while governments find new ways to create liquid assets and investors keep finding new ways to take advantage of that liquidity to grow their capital, the rest of us are left holding the bag, taking on debt that we can't afford to live with or live without, staying in homes that get more expensive than we can keep up with. Parasitic landlords using every trick in the book to either kick us out or gouge us for more than last year. And it sucks. And I know what you're thinking. Just having more money would be great. Getting a raise, unionizing your workplace, clawing back more of those profits from capitalist bosses would be a huge relief with all this horrible stuff happening behind the scenes. But here's the truth. It'll never be enough. So long as housing remains privatized and this entire system of mortgage-backed liquidity keeps pushing the cost of living up, they're gonna keep draining you of any gains you make. Like that RealPage guy said, if they think you can afford to pay more, they'll charge you more. We need more than higher wages. We need tenants' unions, social housing programs, rent strikes, but most of all, a definite end to capitalism. This system demands that its wealth keeps growing in value, but capitalists can't bear to pay the cost of it themselves. It will never be enough to just underpay you. They will overcharge and overburden you with debt to keep their stupid little game running. So until decent, livable housing is a public right, not a commodity, not collateral, not an asset, a right that we are all entitled to owning for ourselves, you will never be able to afford a home. It's just too useful for them to keep you scrambling. As I mentioned at the beginning of the video, you can now find Second Thought on Means TV, the home for worker-owned entertainment. I've been working with the team to bring on a bunch more creators, so stay tuned for some exciting new additions to the roster. If you're not already familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos, to original series like Means Morning News, to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. As you all know, socialist creators have to walk a fine line here on YouTube. We're always having to contend with age restriction, demonetization, and outright suppression, which for some reason, right-wing outlets never have to deal with. But now with Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means TV gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and their fans right on the platform. And the best part is, Means TV is ideologically dedicated to supporting principled socialist content. As a little thank you for watching my channel, if you sign up with my link, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get 20% off the whole year. A full year of Means TV will run you just $88, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using my link is directly contributing to the financial stability of my channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Both Second Thought and Means TV are entirely grassroots funded, and they always will be. So if you'd like to help support my work, consider signing up for Means TV using my link. It really does help me and dozens of principled socialist creators all across the platform. If you enjoyed this video, consider dropping a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out my other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.